From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Baby, baby, sweet baby.
On today's Fresh Air, on this Martin Luther King Day, we'll hear from Aretha Franklin. We'll listen with the Queen of Soul to some of her greatest records, hear the stories behind them, and we'll talk about singing gospel in her father's church and how she crossed over to soul music. Aretha Franklin, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Race relations was the topic tonight in Iowa as Democrats Bill Bradley and Al Gore squared off in the run-up to the Iowa caucuses. Vice President Gore said that if he's elected, he'll sign an executive order to end racial profiling in law enforcement agencies. Former Senator Bill Bradley pointed out that Gore works for Bill Clinton, who already has that authority.
I want you to walk down that hallway, walk into his office, and say, sign this executive order today.
Vice President Gore?
I don't think President Bill Clinton needs a lecture from Bill Bradley about how to stand up and fight for African Americans and Latinos.
In their sixth and final debate before Monday's Iowa caucuses, the two Democratic hopefuls agreed the Confederate flag should come down from atop the South Carolina State House. A group of close to 50,000 demonstrators today evoked the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as they protested the South Carolina policy during a march on the state capitol. The United States said today the postponement of top-level Israeli and Syrian peace talks this week was a setback, but said lower-level officials would visit Washington to try to make some progress. Senior U.S. officials suggested that the key reason for the postponement was Israel and Syria's inability to agree on which issues to tackle first, saying each side wants its key concerns to be addressed before the others. At the United Nations, Secretary General Kofi Annan nominated a new chief arms inspector for Iraq. But already Baghdad is rejecting the nominee. Linda Fasulo reports.
Over the past month, Annan vetted some two dozen names with key Security Council members, but to no avail. Not one was acceptable to all five veto-wielding members, including Annan's current choice, former UNSCOM chief Ralph Ekéus of Sweden. Russia, China, and France have been opposing his return. But as the 30-day Security Council deadline expired, Annan proposed Ekéus, according to his spokesman Fred Eckhart, because he thought him best for the job. Security Council members have 24 hours to formally voice objection to the nominee, or he will be appointed. Meanwhile, Baghdad's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz is rejecting Annan's choice, saying it's like putting old wine into new bottles. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo in New York.
David Letterman might be out of the hospital as soon as Friday. That would be a week after having quintuple bypass heart surgery. Doctors say he's doing fine. Whenever Letterman gets out of the hospital, he'll still stay home to rest for at least a month and a half. CBS will run reruns of The Late Show until he gets back. You're listening to NPR News. During a lengthy meeting with European delegation, acting Russian President Vladimir Putin said he was open to specific suggestions on how to end the conflict in Chechnya. NPR's Anne Garrels reports from Moscow.
Acting President Vladimir Putin met with the delegation from the Council of Europe, a human rights body of which Russia is a member, for 3 hours. The delegation repeated its concerns about civilian casualties and called for negotiations. Far from dismissing the delegation's protests, Putin heard them out and appealed for understanding. To Putin's claims he cannot find a reliable negotiator on the Chechen side, the delegation said he should at least start with Chechen President Maschadov. Indicating an important change, Putin said he's ready to accept an international presence in Chechnya. The head of the delegation, Lord David Russell Johnston, seemed cautiously encouraged. So far, most foreign journalists and human rights organizations have been blocked from Chechnya. Anne Garrels, NPR News, Moscow.
Two people have been killed in storms in the Pacific Northwest that have forced the closing of Seattle's Space Needle. A spokeswoman said the wind at the top of the 610-foot structure was clocked at 100 miles an hour. She said the tower sways about an inch for every 10 miles an hour of wind. The storms knocked out power to hundreds of thousands of people. Marine environment experts said today they're not sure why an estimated 75 to 100 bottlenose dolphins have beached themselves along shores in the Florida Keys. They say as many as 25 have died. Other strandings involving fewer dolphins have been reported at two other spots in the Keys. Bottlenose dolphins normally live 40 miles or more offshore, but have been known to head for the coast when one or more in the group falls ill. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novasoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this Martin Luther King Day, our guest is the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin.
I am getting the spirit in the dark. I'm getting the spirit in the dark. People moving, oh, in the grooving, just getting the spirit in the dark. Tell me, sister, how do you feel?
You can always hear the sound of the church in Aretha Franklin's music, and that's because it's where she got her start. Her father, Reverend C.L. Franklin, was a famous preacher. Franklin talks about her family and her music in her recent autobiography, Aretha. It's written with David Ritz, who also worked with Ray Charles, B.B. King, and Smokey Robinson on their books. Aretha Franklin has been given many awards in her career. She was the first woman inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Last fall, she received a National Medal of the Arts from the President and First Lady. But she seldom gives interviews, so we were delighted to have the chance to speak with her. Our interview was recorded in October. Before you sang soul music, you sang gospel in the church. I imagine gospel was more than just music to you. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, feeling the spirit when you sang?
Certainly gospel was my background, is my background. My upbringing was in the church. We had to attend regularly. And, of course, the church provided a training ground for me, so to speak, as a young vocalist, and certainly gave me all of the spiritual values that I needed as a young lady.
I'd like to play a recording that was made of you at the age of 14, singing in the church in which your father was pastor, the New Bethel Church in Detroit.
Yes, New Bethel Baptist Church.
And this is a recording of Precious Lord. The version we're going to hear was made in 1956. This is the young 14-year-old Aretha Franklin.
When my way and all
That's the young Aretha Franklin. Let's talk a little bit about the influences on you during your formative years. First of all, let's talk a little bit about your father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin. He was one of the mm-hmm. most popular preachers of his generation. He was nationally known through his tours and through, I think, radio broadcasts as well as recordings. You say in the book that church nurses carried smelling salts to revive worshipers who were overcome to the point of fainting by the Spirit or by your father's sermons. What was it like for you to watch your father speak and people fainting in church?
Well, it was tremendous. I love going to church. I enjoyed being a part of the choir and just doing things in and around the church. But as a young girl, I certainly enjoyed watching and listening to my dad.
You toured with your father through churches through the Deep South, and I'm wondering what it was like for you during the days of segregation to tour through the Deep South, you know, how that compared to what you were used to in Detroit.
Well, it certainly was not what I was used to or accustomed to in Detroit. But on the other hand, it was not that bad. We didn't have extreme experiences of any kind, but there were times that we were asked to go to the back of the restaurant, say, or we couldn't use the bathrooms. And we got information that you could use the bathrooms there if you, and we didn't buy gas where we could not use the restrooms. So we went to golf a lot, I must tell you.
You say about your father, he was a minister, he was also a man, and that some women pursued him aggressively night and day.
Mm-hmm. They did.
So he wasn't uncomfortable with that.
I have no idea. I never discussed it with him, and he never discussed that sort of thing with his children. But as children, we could certainly see that women were kind of aggressively taking off behind him. He was single at the time, and sometimes you might see it with a lady sitting on the front row, a little high, skirts a little high, a little short, things like that, or in other ways that we're all familiar with. You know when women are interested.
Mm-hmm. I thought I'd play an excerpt from what is perhaps his most famous recorded sermon, The Eagle Stirreth. Since we'll only be hearing an excerpt just to get a sense of his style of preaching, can you tell us a little bit about what the sermon was actually about?
Having to do, as I equate it, to life, to children, to the parental function in the raising of one's children, and in certain other ways, there are parallels to your personal life.
My guest is Aretha Franklin. She has a new autobiography. Let's hear an excerpt of a sermon preached by her father, Reverend C.L. Franklin.
Most of us forget it. Yeah, right. It is said that that was a man who had a poultry farm.
Yes.
And that he raised chickens for the market.
Yes.
And one day in one of his broods, he discovered a strange-looking bird.
Yes.
That was very much unlike the other chickens on the yard.
Yes.
And the man didn't pay too much attention, but he noticed as time went on that this strange-looking bird was unusual.
Yes.
He outgrew the other little chicken.
Yes.
Oh, Lord. And then one day a man who knew eagles, when he saw it, came along and saw that little eagle walking in the yard. And he said to his friend, "Do you know that you have an eagle here?
Yes.
What you ought to do is build a cage.
Yes,
after a while, when he's a little older, he's going to get tired of the ground.
Yes,
yes he will. Yes. He's going to rise up on the pinion of his wings.
Yes.
So one day, when the eagle had gotten grown,
Lord God,
and his wings were 12 feet from tip to tip. Oh, Lord. He began to get restless in the cage. Yes, he did. He began to walk around and be uneasy. The man watched him. He walked around uneasy. Oh, Lord. He said, Lord, heart goes out to him. I believe I'll go and open the door and set the eagle free. Oh, Lord, he went there and opened the door. Yes. The eagle walked out. Yes. Spotted his wings. Yes. Up and down. Yes. One of you did. My soul is an eagle. In the cave that the Lord had made for me.
Aretha Franklin's late father, Reverend C.L. Franklin. Many singers who grew up in the church weren't allowed by their parents to listen to or to perform pop music. It wasn't that way in your family. What did your father think about pop music and jazz?
My dad, I think, appreciated gifted artists. We just didn't have that problem in our home. Rockin' with Leroy used to come on when I would come in from school. It was a very, very big R&B broadcast of the day when I was a young girl. And I would come in and put my books down, lie down on the floor, and listen to Rockin' with Leroy. My dad really appreciated music. He appreciated gifted artists, as I said. And he never tried to limit us in any way with respect to music or anything like that.
Well, as you describe in your new autobiography, great performers like Nat Cole and Art Tatum knew your father and would sometimes be in your living room at the piano. That must have been
something. Yes, that's true. Art Tatum was often a visitor in our home. He was a very good friend of my dad's, Oscar Peterson, and Arthur Prysock, Mahalia Jackson, of course, James, and he loved Sam Cooke. And he just really very broadly appreciated one's artistry when they were truly gifted and really good.
My guest is Aretha Franklin. She has a new autobiography. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Aretha Franklin. She has a new autobiography. Could you describe the neighborhood that you grew up in?
The neighborhood that I grew up in was the north end of Detroit, and we stayed on Boston Boulevard just off of Oakland. And in that particular neighborhood were some people that we all know. Smokey Robinson lived just a block from me. Diana Ross lived a few doors from Smokey. Most of the Miracles stayed on the North End. It was pretty much a middle class, middle to upper class neighborhood on the North End of Detroit.
growing up in the same neighborhood with Diana Ross and Smokey Robinson, were you aware of each other as performers? And did you expect did they expect that you would go on to be such famous people?
We were aware of each other. Smokey and my brother and my family have always been best friends from small children on until today. Diana, I used to see occasionally out on the porch coming from Smokey's home, going back home. But he and my brother Cecil were best friends.
Now, you were friends with Sam Cooke, the great gospel singer turned soul singer. How did you meet?
Sam and I met at a Sunday evening program that we had at our church back in the early 50s. And I was sitting there waiting for the program to start after church, and I just happened to look back over my shoulder, and I saw this group of people coming down the aisle, and oh my God, the man that was leading them, Sam, and his brother LC, and these guys were really super sharp. They had on beautiful blue and navy blue and brown trench coats, and I had never seen anyone quite as attractive, not a male as attractive as Sam was. And so prior to the program, my soul was kind of being stirred in another way.
Well, now, he crossed over from gospel to pop before you did. What impact did it have on you when you heard him having a hit pop song on the radio?
What impact did it have on me when Sam crossed over?
Mm-hmm.
We were going down the highway. We were somewhere in the South. And my sister and I and the driver and maybe one or two other people in the car, we knew that he had left the gospel field. And, of course, I was rather sad about that. But as we were driving, we knew that he had recorded. And just out of the dark came this fabulous voice, and it was Sam, and it was his first record, and he was singing You Send Me, and there was just pandemonium in the car. My sister and I just had a fit. We really had to pull over and stop the car and settle down. Oh, my God, it's Sam. It's Sam. It's his record. You know, it was like that. You Send Me. It's his record, you know, and there was just so much excitement in the car. The driver really had to pull over.
So did that make you think, maybe I should consider making pop records?
Well, I don't know at the time. I don't think that was my feeling, and it wasn't to begin with. But as time went on and I just began to listen to more and more of his recordings, and I loved them the way they were produced, the melodies, the background singers. As time went on, I began to think about the broader view. I was interested in changing fields as well, but I was not as confident, I guess, as Sam was to begin with. And finally, I said, well, if Sam made it, maybe I could too. And I was willing to give it a try.
Well, you were living in Detroit, so when you decided to make pop records, I mean, the obvious choice, I suppose, would have been Motown, especially since Berry Gordy was a friend of the family. I guess Motown was a very new label at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But did you consider Motown?
Actually, no, I really did not. My dad and I had talked about it, and we really kind of had our sights set on Columbia Records out of New York. We knew that Columbia was a worldwide label, and I think the feeling probably was that the promotion would be better than, say, a Motown, or the distribution and the promotion and so on. And so we just kind of maintained that feeling that Columbia and other major record labels were the people that we wanted to talk to.
Well, you were signed at Columbia by John Hammond, who had earlier signed Count Basie and later signed Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen. Well, I want to play the first track that you recorded with John Hammond, and it's Today I Sing the Blues.
Okay.
Without a word of warning, the blues walked in this morning. and circled around my lonely room. I didn't know why I had that sad and lonely feeling until my baby called and said, we're through. Yesterday, this time I sing a love song, but today I'm singing the blues. It strikes me kind of funny how love can be this way. But I'm alone again today. And it strikes me kind of funny how fate can be unfair. Be written for me that I should be the one to always lose.
Aretha Franklin's autobiography is called Aretha, From These Roots. We'll continue the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Bantam Books, publisher of Working with Emotional Intelligence by Daniel Goleman, author of Emotional Intelligence. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Aretha Franklin talks about her years at Atlantic Records when she recorded most of her hits. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. She has a new autobiography called Aretha, From These Roots. When we left off, we were talking about the jazz recording she made before her soul music hits. Let's hear another session that you recorded when you were at Columbia Records. And this is an arrangement by Bob Mercy. The song is Skylark. Now, this is a period when you were recording with strings and voices behind you. Did you feel comfortable with this kind of setting?
Oh, I love that. Mm-hmm. I loved it. Mm-hmm. Bob Mercy was, in my opinion, the best arranger, string arranger of the day. He certainly did some of Streisand's things and other artists that were on Columbia. at the time, but he was one of the absolute best. And then came Arif Mardin, who was at Atlantic Records after Bob Mercy.
Okay, well, let's hear your version of Skylark.
Won't you tell me where my love can be? Is there a meadow in mist where someone's waiting to be kissed? Skylark, have you seen a valley green? Can go journeying over the shadows and the rain to a blossom-covered lane, and in your lonely flight, oh, haven't you heard music in the night? Faint as a will-o'-the-wisp, crazy as blue, sad as a gypsy, serenading the moon. Skylark, oh, I don't know if you can find. So if you see them anywhere, won't you lead me there?
That's Aretha Franklin from the early part of her pop recording career, Hoagy Carmichael's Skylark. Now, you were playing a lot of clubs during those early years, and a lot of those clubs were jazz clubs, and the people who you shared a bill with included John Coltrane and Charles Mingus. Mm-hmm. Was this a new kind of music for you?
Not exactly a new kind of music. As a very small girl, I listened to Charlie Parker and loved him, and Max Roach and people like that. I had not been in the jazz environment, having been brought up in the church. But once I got to New York and I was signed to perform at the Village Gate and the Vanguard and clubs like that, and these the Vanguard was one of the most elite, if not the most elite, jazz club out there. Then I began to meet jazz musicians and to become more familiar with that environment and comfortable with it.
What was different about the jazz environment? What were some of the things you hadn't been exposed to before?
Well, I certainly had not been exposed to Charlie Mingus reaching over, and I think he slapped the pianist that one night.
Right. Sounds like Mingus.
Sitting in the audience then. This was at the Village Gate, and he kept right on playing. You know, nobody missed a beat.
My guest is Aretha Franklin. She has a new autobiography. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Darling, you send me, darling. do, honey, you do, honey, you do. Oh, you thrill me. Darling, you thrill me.
My guest is Aretha Franklin. She has a new autobiography. In 1966, after your contract with Columbia Records was up, you moved to Atlantic Records, which was the home of rhythm and blues greats like Ruth Brown and Ray Charles, Laverne Baker, The Drifters, The Clovers. How did you end up at Atlantic?
We got a call. My former husband, Ted White, got a call from Jerry Wexler that they were interested in talking to and signing me at Atlantic Records. And we went over, we sat, and we talked to Jerry. Jerry offered a delightful little bonus. And, of course, the rest is history.
Your sound really changed at Atlantic, and so did your material. Mm-hmm. Did he set you down before you started recording and say, this is what I see for you, this is what I hear?
Yes, he did. Actually, where I had been in the booth most of the time at Columbia, and not at the piano, Jerry asked me to sit down and accompany myself. And that is where my career really took a drastic 160-degree turnaround. I just accompany myself in a very different way than most other pianists do. And I think that that was the factor that made the difference.
For your first Atlantic recording session, the producer Jerry Wexler took you down to a studio in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, that was famous for its great session men, which included Dan Penn and Spooner Oldham. And the first song that you recorded there was I Never Loved a Man. Now, Spooner Oldham tells the story that when he heard you sit down at the piano and play your first chord, he thought, wow, that's really great. And that he, he's a pianist, that he should let you play piano while he moved over to electric piano playing behind you. What'd you think of that arrangement? Were you pleased that he agreed that you should be the one at the piano?
I remember that particular session. It was the very first session, so naturally, yes, I remember it. And we really were kind of struggling at that point to get to the music. It just wasn't quite coming off, although we had dynamite players. We had the Muscle Shoals section, and they were really very, very hot, cutting a lot of good greasy stuff, or what you would call greasy in that day. But we weren't getting to the music in the way that we should have. It just wasn't coming off. And finally, someone said, Aretha, why don't you sit down and play? And I did. And it just happened. It all just happened. We arrived, and we arrived very quickly.
Well, Peter Guralnick, the music critic, describes this recording, I Never Loved a Man, as one of the most momentous takes in the history of rhythm and blues, in fact, in the history of American vernacular music. Let's hear it. This is my guest, Aretha Franklin.
You're no good heartbreaker. You're a liar and you're a cheat. And I don't know why I let you do these things. Keep telling me that you ain't no good. Oh, oh, but they don't know that I'd leave you if I could. I guess I'm uptight and I'm stuck like glue. 'Cause I ain't never loved no. I love you. Yeah. I love you.
That's Aretha Franklin, her first recording for Atlantic Records. Now, your second single was Respect, which is, I believe, mm-hmm. your still most requested song. How did you end up singing this Otis Redding song?
Well, I heard Mr. Redding's version of it. I just loved it, and I decided that I wanted to record it. And my sister Carolyn and I got together. I was living in a small apartment on the west side of Detroit, and piano by the window, watching the cars go by. And we came up with that infamous line, the sock it to me line. It was a cliche of the day. Actually, we didn't just come up with it. It really was cliche. And some of the girls were saying that to the fellas, like, sock it to me in this way or sock it to me in that way. Nothing sexual, and it's not sexual. It was non-sexual, just a cliche line. But anyway, Laugh In picked it up, and it just kind of perpetuated itself and went on from there.
Well, let's hear Aretha Franklin singing Respect. Aretha Franklin, who has a new autobiography, which is called Aretha From These Roots. What did this song mean to you when you sang it? I mean, really part of the backdrop of this song, it was a hit during the Civil Rights Movement. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, Respect had a lot of meanings in this song for your listeners. One was, you know, just the respect you wanted from a man in a relationship. But it also mm-hmm. had, I think, a larger resonance with the Civil Rights Movement, you know, a kind of larger social, cultural sense of respect.
Yes, in later times it was picked up as a battle cry by the Civil Rights Movement. But when I recorded it, it was pretty much a male-female kind mm-hmm. of thing. And more in a general sense from person to person. I'm going to give you respect, and I'd like to have that respect back, or I expect respect to be given back.
you know, as we mentioned, the song, I think, resonated with the civil rights movement. Your family was good friends with Martin Luther King. How well did you know Dr. King?
Dr. King was a family friend and a very good friend of my dad's. And occasionally he would come to Detroit and spend time in our home or at our church, at my dad's church. I went out in the early days of the civil rights movement and did some performances for him along with Esther Morrow and Harry Belafonte and different other vocalists, Bernard Lee, who was a foot soldier, Reverend Jackson, with Dr. King in those days.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to play another song that I think, you know, had a lot of resonance both in terms of personal relationships, but had a larger resonance too because of the refrain, freedom, freedom. And this is the song, Think, which you wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what you were thinking about when you wrote this song.
The song, Think, really had to do with a personal relationship that I was involved in that really I didn't think was very good for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so Think became the result of that.
And this is your 1968 recording. Aretha Franklin recorded in 1968. She has a new autobiography called Aretha, From These Roots. Now, is that the Sweet Inspirations behind you on that track?
Yes, it is.
Now, you know that it was the ambition of many young women to someday be a sweet inspiration. Of course, they knew they wouldn't be, so they just kind of did the backup vocals in their living rooms. So what's it like for you as a singer to have really good backup vocalists behind you? Is that a real boost?
It's certainly meaningful, yes. There's a lot of interplay between the lead singer and the background, and of course they are very, very supportive to the lead. And it's great. You can create with them and just come up with whatever your objectives, your musical objectives are.
My guest is Aretha Franklin. She has a new autobiography. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
We got our love and some R-E-S-P-C-T-O. Oh, oh. Like sweet morning dew, took one look at you, and it was plain to see. You were my destiny. With my arms open wide, I threw away my pride. I sacrificed for you, dedicate my life to you. I will go where you lead. I'll be right there in a time of need. And when I lose my will, you'll be right there to push me up that hill. There's no, oh, no looking back for.
My guest is Aretha Franklin. She has a new autobiography. When you were at Columbia Records, you had some success and performed at a lot of clubs, but you didn't have hit records. When you were at Atlantic, you had hit after hit after hit and became, you know, the queen of soul. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there were things about success that surprised you or that you were really unprepared for.
mainly, I think the thing that I was most unprepared for was the traveling. I went out on a couple of tours, and those tours were my first and very last tours. I went out on a tour with Sam for about a month, and I never should have done that. Just far too many days, too much getting on and off airplanes every day, and in and out of hotels, and it just was not something that I was accustomed to or ready for. And, of course, I did one with Jackie Wilson sometime after that, but I never did another tour of that to that extent or that degree after that.
What was your father, Reverend Franklin's, reaction to your being the Queen of Soul?
He loved it. He loved it. My dad was my greatest fan, I think, with along with my brother Cecil, and who was my former manager as well.
Now, one of the things that's affected your performing career is fear of flying. You don't like to fly, and that's obviously affected mm-hmm. your ability to tour. Do you know how you mm-hmm. developed fear of flying?
I had a bad flight coming from Atlanta in the 80s. I was in a hurry to get home. We missed all of the big jets, and all that was left was a two-engine plane, and I said, well, we'll take that. Big mistake. Never should have done that. It was just dipsy-doodling all over the sky, and by the time we got to Detroit, I was a nervous wreck. And, of course, I really knew what it meant when you see the Pope kissing the ground. I really knew what that was about. By the time we reached Metropolitan Airport, I was a nervous wreck, and just have not flown since.
So you never flew at all after that?
No, I have not flown since 83. I attended a Fearless Flyers class that U.S. Air had a few years back, but in still concertizing around the country, and I, at that point, was using a custom bus, missed several of the last classes. And by the time it was time for my class to fly, I didn't feel that I was ready at the time. So I've just got to get back in one of these air classes or something and move it along.
What do you most like to sing now?
I love to sing everything. Right now I am working on two arias that I am preparing for my performance with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. I am doing Doretta's aria, and I'm also doing Ombra Mai Fu.
Did you ever listen to opera when you were young, or is this a new interest
mm-hmm.
of yours?
Yes, I did. No. I heard opera as a very, very young child. Maria Lanza used to play in our home. I don't know how it got there, but it was there. There was a passage in the book where Smokey's niece, Sylvia, and Irma are lying under the big radio, this 1930s, 1940s radio, and Maria Lanza is playing, and Sylvia is lying there with her ear pressed to the speaker, crying. And I'm observing all of this, watching Irma and Sylvia, and I think it is a riot. It's the funniest thing I've ever seen. Why is she crying? I could just never figure that out. As a little girl, of course, as I became older and a teenager, certainly I realized her sensitivity to the music and that sort of thing mm-hmm. and the way that she was relating, but I thought it was the funniest thing as a child.
Aretha Franklin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And
it's been my pleasure, and thank you so much for having me.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Aretha Franklin recorded last October after the publication of her autobiography, Aretha, From These Roots. It's written with David Ritz. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Brendan Noonan. I'm Terry Gross.
To feel so uninspired.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support from the Dial Press, publisher of Letters of the Century, edited by Lisa Grunewald and Stephen Adler. A collection of over 400 letters from famous figures and ordinary citizens intimately chronicling our country's history. And from Beacon Press, publishers of All Souls, A Family Story from Southie by Michael Patrick McDonald. Available at bookstores everywhere, on the web at www.beacon.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Keith Sokola's song, Indian Car, has been described as a contemporary Native American anthem. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with him about how his rock songs connect with his Indian heritage. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.